This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Why do mysteries have such a grip on our imagination? You know, in a distressed publishing industry, mystery novels are consistent bestsellers, and TV crime dramas like NCIS are in the top spot of the Nielsen ratings. Maybe it's because mysteries suggest a world in which bad deeds are punished and good men and women uncover the truth. Books to Die For is a collection of essays from prominent mystery writers about their own favorites. John Connolly co-edited the book with Declan Burke, and John is with us today. We also want to hear from you. Read any good mysteries lately? Give us a call. What do you like about mysteries? What do you think? Who are the best mystery writers? What are some of the best that have ever been written? Call us at 877-962-9862, sot@wunc.org. Maybe you hate mysteries. Maybe you think they should never be committed to print. John, I'm sure, has heard all of that, too, and he has an answer for you. He will talk with you as well about that at 877-962-9862. John Connolly, welcome to the State of Things. Nice to talk with you.
It's a pleasure to be here, Frank. Thank you.
What are the established traditions? Are there traditions, some way that we can recognize a mystery novel through all the ages?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question. It's often said one of the difficulties is deciding what is a mystery, I suppose. And my co-editor, Declan, came up with an interesting formulation, which was if you can take the body out of the murder out of the book and the book doesn't collapse, then it's probably not a mystery. If you take the murder out of the book and the book collapses, that was a mystery. So by that token, say Dostoevsky's Crime and Punishment is a mystery novel, but say The Great Gatsby isn't, although each has an unexplained death in it or there's a body in it. But I suppose the traditions go right back to the interesting point is the 1920s. That's a good point of division when we can decide what is or isn't a mystery, because two very different traditions emerge. One is what we call the British cozy tradition, or I suppose you want to call it the traditional mystery. And that's Agatha Christie, Dorothy L. Sayers, people like Marjorie Allingham to a degree. And quite often in these books, what happens is a murder is committed. The person who dies usually isn't a very nice person. You know, they're often in Christie's novels, they're often blackmailers or adulterers and petty thieves, and they get it in the neck because they've kind of been asking for it. As Julian Simmons once said, in these books, it's not murder, it's contributory negligence. And then and somebody comes in and solves the crime because it's a matter of order. You know, you can't leave bodies lying around the village. It will make the village look very untidy. But there is also a faith in the establishment, that kind of murder and corruption. These are exceptions rather than the rule. And a very different tradition emerges in the United States at the same time. And it begins in California, I think. And it's probably because California was and is one of the most corrupt states in the Union. When the University of Illinois did a survey last year on the most corrupt states, California came in second. Unfortunately for the University of Illinois, Illinois came in first.
Yeah, so there's no top in Illinois, but go ahead.
No, you should never ask a question to which you don't already know the answer, I suspect.
And New Jersey's in there somewhere, but please do continue. Yeah,
New Jersey and Louisiana, there's no shortage of them. But I think what's interesting about California is it was a state that was bought and paid for by the railroads. The railroads ran California in the 20s and 30s because all industry was so dependent upon the railroads moving their stock for them. And so if you were a poor person in California, if you were vulnerable in some way, if you were an immigrant, if for some reason you didn't have wealth and privilege on your side, then the forces of law and order probably were not going to stand up for you in the same way that they were going to for the wealthy and the privileged. And if that's the case, you need somebody from outside the establishment to make a stand for you. And I think that's why the Private Eye novel begins in the United States. There's no tradition of the Private Eye novel in Britain, because I don't think there was that lack of faith in the establishment. And so often the people who die in these novels, if you read Chandler or particularly Ross Macdonald, who's a favourite of mine, the people who die in them suffer usually through no fault of their own. They suffer because they're in the wrong place at the wrong time. They suffer because they have crossed the wealthy and the privileged. They suffer often because of something that their parents have done or the previous generation has done. And then a detective from outside comes in and tries to achieve a measure of justice for them. So I suppose if you want to kind of, in two broad strokes, want to describe the two defining traditions in the genre, that wouldn't be a bad place to start.
That's a great overview, John, I think, and it gives us a sense of the scope of the mystery novel and some of the real serious differences, ways we can distinguish one from the other. So let's get back to this idea of the cozy novel, because there's something else that people think about when they think about novels, particularly that cozy novel where the order has been disrupted and it has to be somehow, reestablished. So think about Agatha Christie, right? And you know, this is something I think that's pretty firmly in the cozy literature camp. So here, a mystery solved by an eccentric genius, Poirot, who's putting the pieces together. Let's listen to this clip from the film adaptation of Murder on the Orient Express.
Why did you bring this dagger from the place?
Because I found it in my makeup bag.
Give me the dagger.
When
When did you last open your makeup bag?
Yesterday evening when I took everything out.
If you took everything out, why did you need to reopen it?
Because I was putting something back in.
You may set your mind at rest, Mrs. Hubbard. Are you going back to the dining car?
I'll say I am. Do you think I could face my compartment so soon after that?
Would you kindly ask the chief attendant to arrange the tables and chairs so that Signor Bianchi, Dr. Constantine, and myself can confront the passengers with the solution of the murder?
Here we go. We're all going to sit in a room and hear the solution. And that, of course, John, is the complaint about the so-called cozy novel. They follow a pretty rigorous formula. Was there something about Agatha Christie? Does her work – is there something else there that we're missing, those of us who might be critics of her work?
Oh, I think so. Well, actually, that clip you brought up raises something very interesting. Sometimes thrillers and mysteries get put together in the same bag, and I'm not sure they're the same. Thrillers tend to roam. They tend to range. They tend to move across territories. They tend to be quite expansive. Mysteries thrive on containment. And that's Murder on the Orient Express is the great example of that. It's a lot of people stuck on a train. They can't go anywhere. But similarly, Christie uses villages in the same way. You know, as Chandler used a whole of Los Angeles. He turned Los Angeles into a village, essentially. But Christie uses villages. She's much more subversive than she's given credit for. I used the term cozy earlier. And even when I did it, I kind of winced myself because it's a little bit unfair. Because what Christie does is show us what seems to be a very normal little English village where people go about their business and, you know, bobbies ride bicycles and the telephone boxes are painted red, and there's probably flowers in the little roundabout at the centre of town. And then it suddenly turns out that all of the people in this village are filled with kind of petty rivalries and jealousies and hatreds, and some of them hate enough that they will kill somebody for it, you know? And so she's actually much cleverer and much more of a kind of social critic than she's given credit for, I think. So even within what we regard as the very, very cosy, the kind of the extreme of cosy, or the definition of the cosy novel, there's something quite quirky and interesting going on, I think, and even in the case of Christie.
Talking to John Connolly, co-editor of a book, a collection of essays called Books to Die For, the World's Greatest Mystery Writers on the World's Greatest Mystery Novels. And we're inviting your comments today at 877-962-9862. Whether you like them or hate them, give us a call. So does that mean then, John, do you think that to be a great mystery writer, there has to be something else going on? You have to be some kind of moralist? You have some other message that you're hoping, or at least is prying in your mind as a writer?
I'm not entirely sure. I think even within all types of fiction, there are novels which are just pretty disposable, where you can go on and get on an aeroplane and they will quite happily pass 3 hours or so as you're getting on your flight to Florida or whoever it is. I mean, you don't always want to be carrying on Proust every time you go on an aeroplane. So we have different expectations when we pick up a book. But I think crime novel is very well suited to social criticism, to questions of justice and morality and compassion and empathy. And a lot of writers find themselves drawn to mystery because that's the ideal forum for exploring those themes. So, you know, while it is entertaining, while it does tend to have a decent plot that will keep the pages turning, and I would rather read an average mystery novel than an average piece of literary fiction. And the flip side of that is I might rather read a great piece of literary fiction than even a great mystery novel. Mm. And there's a point at which the lines blur. But nevertheless, I think that there is, for all writers, and all writers who are serious about their craft, and you know, mystery writers are as serious as anybody, you try and find truths. That's what fiction is about. Fiction is about finding the universal and the specific. And so we become attracted to subjects, to topics that are of interest to us, but that also concern us deeply, you know. And as human beings, that idea of the disparity between law and justice is a very interesting one. The writer William Gaddis in J. Orr, he said that in the next world we have justice, in this world we have the law. Mm. Now, that's a very interesting distinction to draw. And I think anybody who's ever had direct experience of dealing with the law will come out of it feeling pretty battered and bruised. Yeah. The only people who come out happy out of law cases are lawyers. You know, those of us who get drawn into the legal system find it a very turbulent, upsetting and traumatic experience. And we often come out at the other end feeling that we haven't received a measure of justice. You know, it's even interesting reading the papers today about Jerry Sandusky. And, you know, the complaints of the victims were saying, well, this is not, you know, 30 years is not what we imagined as justice, even though this man has been tried and found guilty and is probably going to spend the rest of his life behind bars in a very unpleasant way. Even then, there is a kind of dissatisfaction with the way that the law worked. And what crime fiction does in a very interesting way is it's tear apart that dichotomy, that disparity between law and justice, and say, well, look, what does this mean exactly?
And has it... Right. Well, and I wonder if it's evolved, because now sort of in those cozy mysteries, the cozy novel, you know, the bad guy is always brought to at least the law, if not justice. But we do see that crime does pay, that good doesn't always triumph over evil, even in a good mystery, right?
Well, that's absolutely true. The endings we get in mysteries tend to be compromised. The people who solve them, the detectives at their heart, they tend to be damaged individuals, and they tend to get more damaged as series go on, because you can't keep coming up against that darkness that is in people and that is in our society and not be affected by it. On the other hand, when we read a crime pages of a newspaper, if we encounter the law, if we get drawn into it, what we recognise is that often, you should say, crime does pay. Bad people do bad things and they get away with it. And the writer Edmund Burke, the Irish writer and essayist Edmund Burke, once said that all that it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to stand by and do nothing. Mm. And I think as we get older, we become more and more conscious of the fact that a lot of people seem to stand by. When we're younger as well, we tend to have a passion for it, because young people in particular have a passion for justice. Some of that kind of maybe gets knocked out of us as we go along in life, and then some of us get angry again. Mystery fiction gives you endings that you don't always get in real life. I think we would be very unhappy if we picked up a mystery novel and finished it and at the end of it the criminal got away with it. I don't think we would consider that a satisfactory reading experience as far as the mystery is concerned.
John Connolly co-edited Books to Die For, Four with Declan Burke. Our conversation is going to continue. We're going to take your phone calls in just a minute, but I want to let you know that John's going to be reading at McIntyre Books in Pittsburgh at 4 o'clock on Sunday, October 14th. Our program with John and this discussion of mysteries and your phone calls continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio, today talking to John Connolly. He recently co-edited a collection called Books to Die For, essays by mystery writers about their own favorite mysteries. And we want to hear from you as well. 877-962-9862. You love a mystery? Which ones? Why? You think the mystery should never have been committed to print? Let us know as well. 877-962-9862. And Kathy is on the line from Pittsburgh. Hello, Kathy.
Hi, Frank. Good to talk to you.
Great to talk with you. Got a question for us?
Well, really more comments. First of all, I'm so glad that your guest, talked about the greater depth of Agatha Christie, because I love her and I think she is a master. I never liked mysteries until about 20 years ago when I started listening to them on audio tape, and I find that a very exciting way to listen, and it's almost like a performance. And I particularly love Murder on the Orient Express. But I wanted to say my favorite mystery writer is Alice Peters, also an English woman. And many people may know she wrote the Brother Cadfael series about the, I think he's 12th century English monk who ends up solving mysteries through a whole combination of his herbology and religion. And spirituality. And in both of these English writers, the way they draw their characters is so wonderful, especially Alice Peters. Her novels are practically like psychological studies. I don't know if your guest agrees or has feelings about Miss Peters, but, and I know that's her pen name. My favorite of hers, and there's a whole long list of them, is The Sanctuary Sparrow.
All right. Well, I tell you what, Kathy, let's get a comment on that, because I love what you said about that, and I'd love to hear what John has to say about it as well. Thank you for calling. John?
That's a very interesting point is raised there. I've read Alice Peters. I think she's a very, very interesting historical novelist and a very, very interesting writer. But the caller made a really, really interesting point, which is character. You know, most of the plots and mystery novels we've read 100 times before, you know, what draws us back to series, mystery series, is the characters at the centre of them. Because we develop an affection for them over a period of time. There are very few genres, whether literary or otherwise, that allow you to return to a character's life year after year after year so that you feel an involvement with their lives. For example, the first crime writer I ever read was Ed McBain. It was Let's Hear It for the Deaf Man. It was the only book my father and I ever fought over, because he really didn't read novels an awful lot. If you read Ed McBain, you know, Ed McBain was writing about the 87 precinct for over half a century. You cannot but develop an affection for these characters. And so when people talk about mystery fiction as being very plot driven, some of it is, but most of it is character driven, because if you think about it, plot is what people do. Plot arises out of character. Right. And if your characters don't sing, if your characters ring hollow, if they're false, everything else that comes along will be false as well. It's the difference between something like Christie or Alice Peters or Ross Macdonald or Raymond Chandler and say Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code, where, you know, there isn't even an attempt to create characters. What you say is, I remember at one point he describes the investigator as, you know, looking like Harrison Ford in Tweed. He couldn't even be bothered coming up with the description of him. He just goes, here's a picture of somebody you might know. Imagine him in a different jacket. So that's kind of what he does. That's an example of a novel that's almost entirely plot-driven rather than character-driven. And a book like that, while you can pass the time with it, when you finish it, it's a bit like finishing a Happy Meal. You know that you've done it, but you don't feel that you particularly need to do it again anytime soon.
Well, it's interesting, too, that what it is about these characters, that they all have these idiosyncrasies. You think of the detective, and then you'll come up with the idiosyncrasy, and we know that. And in a way, isn't that something that helps frame and contain the novel? Because when you're talking about crime, it is chaos. You're in the void. Everything is possible. So something has to remind us that our feet are still on the ground. And is that, do you think, why these characteristics, these idiosyncrasies are so important for all of our lead characters or protagonists?
You know, I think that's a little bit unfair. You know, I don't think we sit down and decide, well, here's a character and I'm going to give him this quirk. You know, somebody like Ross MacDonald writing Blue Archer gives Archer, we learn almost nothing about Archer over the course of a dozen or more, actually must be 20 novels. And yet all we learn about him is that he was once divorced. That's all we get from him. So, you know, you can kind of drop in these quirks and idiosyncrasies. And yes, they can be a bit distracting and irritating after a while, actually. But you know, if you think about it, all human beings have their curiosities and their idiosyncrasies. We all have our quirks, and you know, detectives should be no different. But I agree that sometimes some novelists can certainly hang characters on the hooks of quirks, which is really a bit annoying. But the best of them don't. And if you look at James Lee Burke, say Dave Robichaud, Robichaud has no quirks. You know, he's an exceptionally moral being. But that's it. That's as far as it goes.
Well, Hannibal Lecter, for one, was not the detective, but he certainly had quirks. And this brings me to another kind of character that we haven't talked about yet. So far, we're talking about somebody, even if they're the wounded solver, that one way or another, they're out to find the truth. And it's because they're on the other side of the equation. Then you get this whole genre of characters who are so inside, so criminal themselves, that only their mind can solve it. Let's listen to this bit from Silence of the Lambs.
Do you know why he's called Buffalo Bill? Please tell me. The newspapers won't say.
Well, it started as a bad joke in Kansas City homicide. And they said, this one likes to skin his humps.
Why do you think he removes their skins, agents, darling? Thrill me with your acumen.
It excites him. Most serial killers keep some sort of trophies from their victims.
I didn't.
No. No, you ate yours.
What accounts for this kind of a character who we tolerate as, you know, we don't particularly like, but yeah, they're going to be the solution. We've got to work with them.
You know, Harry Lecter's is kind of an extreme example, and there are very few like him. You know, Harris does something very interesting in those first two books, and I'm thinking of Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs, which I suppose are considered the first two Lecter novels, although Lecter doesn't play a huge part in Red Dragon. And what he does, essentially, he gives us a monster in Lecter, a really monstrous person with kind of peculiarly snobbish tastes. When I read Lecter, I'm reminded a little bit of Ian Fleming's James Bond, you know, where he gives him these kind of superfluous particular cigarettes he likes, and he likes various types of wine, and he just comes across a bit of a snob. You know, he doesn't come across as sophisticated, he's a snob, but he gives us this monster, and then he gives us characters who are as monstrous or more monstrous than him, but don't have those redeeming features of liking nice wine and being able to pick up the best dish on the menu. So he cheats a little bit. Harris makes a terrible mistake in Hannibal. And I'm one of these people I can justify the ending of Hannibal, which has been a subject of great controversy among readers. But he makes a mistake in Hannibal, and a further mistake in Hannibal Rising. He explains the monster. He tells us how Hannibal became Hannibal, and he gives us the most risible explanation for it. And so he almost undoes all of the good work he does in the earlier novels. But actually, the most interesting character in the first of the Lecter novels, in Red Dragon, is not Lecter himself, but is Will Graham. And Will Graham is an investigator who thinks like a criminal. So he's an investigator who can put himself into the criminal's mind and can kind of put together the crime almost after it's been committed, but he almost reimagines it in his mind. And that raises something very interesting. And we'll come back to it about Christie in a minute. If you're a detective who thinks like a criminal, if you're a detective who can imagine exactly what a criminal might do in a crime, how far are you from being a criminal yourself? No. I mean, if you can imagine the thing, if you can put it together, if you can plot it through, you're really only, you're one final step away from it, and that final step away is the act.
And it does something, it's pretty incredible, because if you think about, the say, Sherlock Holmes, there's always this word fiend, so that the criminal is some kind of beast, some sort of total other that I could never be or imagine. But in that genre, yeah, you're right. It turns out that whatever they're doing, I could do, and therefore it is a human quality and not a fiendish, monstrous quality.
Absolutely. It's something that's within all of us. And Christie did something very, very interesting with Poirot, because there's a Poirot novel that was published, I think it was published posthumously, in which it emerges that Poirot is himself a criminal. You know, Poirot has committed a terrible crime. And so what Christie is suggesting is that the only way that he had these insights was because he himself was capable of doing these things. And you know, what's that great phrase, I am human and nothing human is strange to me. One of the things I think that attracts us to mystery fiction and attracts us to these figures is that we wonder, am I capable of doing that? If I was pushed into the right situation, you know, if my husband betrayed me, if my wife cheated on me, would it be possible that I'd get angry enough to do it? Because, you know, most people who commit crimes, we're not evil. Most people are not evil. People are greedy or selfish or weak, or they vacillate, or, you know, they look at their tax return and they think, actually, I could use that money more than the IRS right now. So they cheat. They think, oh, my wife doesn't understand me. So they go behind her back and they have an affair. They don't actively set out to hurt the other person, but hurting them is a function of what they have done. But most of us are not evil. But we have these capacities within us. And I think we're quite fascinated by people who act on them, by people who do these things, because sometimes we wonder how far away from that.
Could I have done it? Talking to John Connolly, co-editor of Books to Die For, and also taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Claire is on the line from Oxford. Hello, Claire.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to comment, as I am a fan of mystery fiction. One of my favorites, of course, is Dorothy Sayers and Agatha Christie. And I wanted to say that the favorite thing that I like to see is when a mystery writer, particularly in this case Agatha Christie, is not turning a convention on its head exactly, but it is turning an expectation on its head in order to create a successful mystery that is more difficult to figure out before the end. And I had a question about that. I was wondering, Christie being so much a mainstay of mystery fiction, and possibly one of an early writer of mystery fiction, if I am right in that, where did these conventions come from, or expectations that she turned on her head to fool her readers?
All right, thanks, Claire.
That's a good question. Yeah. You know, the mystery novel, it goes back quite a... The difficulty is deciding when does the mystery novel start. You can make an argument that Hamlet is a mystery story. You know, Oedipus is a kind of mystery story. But it's generally regarded to kind of come into its own in the 19th century. And a man named Father Ronald Knox, who was an English cleric and probably a dreadful old bore, put together a series of rules for mystery writers quite early in the genre, but before Christie began writing. And you should never trust anybody who starts writing down rules. If you've got that kind of time on your hands, really, you need to go away and stop bothering people. So Father Roland Locke set out a series of rules which are often regarded as kind of the mainstays or main conventions of the genre, and some of them were very odd. One of them, which I've broken repeatedly, is that there should be no supernatural element in a mystery novel. You know, that's not allowed. One of the other ones is there should be no Chinamen, and I'm not sure you can get away with that now. But he was kind of a product of his time, I suppose, when, you know, people like Sax Rohmer would have the Yellow Peril. You know, they would have these fiendish Chinese as villains. So I suppose Christie was aware of the tradition that she was working in, and as that listener very astutely pointed out, she did play with the conventions, and she played with them in very interesting ways. One of the novels by Christie, which is almost impossible to discuss, so I have to be very careful here, is The Murder of Roger Ackroyd. Now, if you're going to pick up one Christie novel, that's probably the one to pick up, because that plays all sorts of very, very interesting games with the reader's expectations of what a mystery should be. And a reader's, you know, if somebody's telling us a story, to what extent do we trust what we're being told? Yeah. It's a very, in a way, it's postmodern before postmodernism. It's a very curious, carefully constructed mystery novel. The interesting, one final thing about Christie, like a lot of people who read Christie, I was one of those people who tried to figure out the murderer. You know, as you're reading the book, you're kind of thinking, well, there must be clues here. And a friend of mine, John Curran, was given access to her notebooks by the Christie estate a couple of years ago and was told to go through them because they wanted to compile a series of kind of companions to Christie. So he went through all her notebooks, and it turned out that Christie didn't know who did the mystery. She'd decide about three quarters of the way through. She'd go, right, it's that bloke. And then she, at the end of it, Poirot would go, it was that bloke over there and here's why. So even this person is regarded as one of the great mechanics of the genre, one of the great plotters. Even she kind of worked it out on the hoof a little bit towards
the
end.
So
all of you who tried to discover it were wrong. You're wasting your time. God love you.
But it turns out it's probably the best way to do it. If you make it plausible for everybody, then of course it keeps us guessing. You know, we talked about this business of this kind of postmodern idea. What do we trust? What don't we trust? I think it gets to maybe, and I'll ask you your opinion on this, that whether or not identity becomes kind of a central theme, kind of what is true. And then as we get into the noir novels, who am I? And then I think we have to talk about Patricia Highsmith. So again, we've got a clip from a film, an adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's Talented Mr. Ripley. Here, the soon-to-be murderer Tom Ripley gives us a flash of his uncanny abilities. Let's listen.
Everybody should have one talent. What's yours?
Forging signatures, telling lies, impersonating practically anybody.
That's three. Nobody should have more than one talent.
Okay.
Do an impression.
Now? The only talent my son has is for cashing his allowance.
What?
Oh, I like to sail. Believe me, I love to sail. Instead, I make boats.
Stop!
Other people sail them.
It's too much. You're making all the hairs on my neck stand up.
Oh, yes, jazz. Oh, jazz, let's face it, it's just insolent noise.
I feel like he's here. Horrible, like the old bastard's here right now.
Good.
That's brilliant. Brilliant! How do you know him?
I met him in New York.
Marge, yeah. This is scary. You gotta hear this. Meet my father, Herbert Richard Greenleaf the First.
A little clip from Talented Mr. Ripley and film adaptation of Patricia Highsmith's novel. I mean, is it fair to make a distinction between the whodunit and the Who Am I, the noir novel that really tries to get at who am I?
I suppose, but I think they're all points on the same scale. What I think about fiction is that in all fiction, character is the great mystery. You know, it is why do people do the things that they do? Who in essence are we? What are we capable of doing? And I think mystery fiction perhaps attempts to provide a more explicit answer than other forms. But I think all fiction is concerned with character because all fiction is concerned with human beings and why they do the things that they do. And as I said earlier, it's an attempt to find the universal in the specific. You know, bringing up Highsmith is very, very... She's another kind of odd case because she does something that very few writers are capable of making us do, which is making us sympathise for somebody that we really shouldn't feel any kind of sympathy for at all, or actually empathise with. This is probably more accurate. She was very good at presenting us with characters who are essentially psychopathic and then making us as readers want them to succeed. Now, why should we want to do that? And her trick, I think, is that she often places them in a very smugly self-satisfied environment. You know, Tom Ripley comes up against these wealthy, kind of vaguely dissolute characters who are kind of living in Europe and living off allowances. And he's kind of, we recognise that he's come up by his boots. He's poor. He doesn't have anybody to protect him. He's very much a self-made man. The problem is that he doesn't know what man he's made. In fact, you could argue that he's about 10 different self-made men. Her most unusual novel, I think, is a book called Deep Water. Which is not one of the Ripley novels. And Deep Water kind of encapsulates this because in Deep Water, a man named Victor Van Allen has been put in his garage by his wife, who keeps cheating on him and parading the younger men that she's going around with in front of him. So he retreats into his garage where he raises snails. So he's a deeply, deeply dislikable human being, unlikable human being. And eventually, when he goes to a party, and this is quite early in the book, his wife parades her latest conquest in front of her husband. And her husband, Victor Van Allen, leans over into this man's ear and he says, "I would be very careful if I were you, because I killed the last person that my wife paraded in front of me like this." And the man goes and looks it up. And true enough, her previous partner has been killed in mysterious circumstances. And we start rooting for Victor Van Allen. I'm not giving anything away there. That's the first two chapters of the book. We begin to root for Victor Van Allen because he does something. You know, he's publishing poetry in this very small, very smug New England town, this very self-satisfied town. And he acts. He acts against these awful, smug people. And we kind of want him to succeed because at least he's doing something. You know, at least he's not sitting there resting on his laurels, looking out from his porch at sunsets and drinking, you know, cheap white wine. He actively, he does something.
He's
and Tom Ripley.
Taking action.
Yeah, he's taken his fate into his hands, and Tom Ripley does the same thing. And that's a very difficult thing to do. It's a very difficult trick to pull off to make readers sympathize in that way with a character that we really shouldn't feel any kind of affection for at all.
John, such a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much.
It's been a real pleasure, Frank. Thank you for your time.
John Connolly, the co-editor of an essay collection called Books to Die For. He reads at McIntyre's Books in Pittsburgh at 4 o'clock on Sunday, October 14th. Up next, Freed Slaves, the Civil War, the Fire of Freedom, how African Americans took control of their own struggle for freedom in America. Stay with us on The State of Things.